some of you know of, and some of you subscribe to the journal Recorded Sound, which I hope the current status of which will be revealed to us. We're all sitting on pins and needles waiting to find out what the next, you know, well, when the other shoe is going to drop, so to speak. The British Institute of Recorded Sound is now a part of the British National Library, and there has been a lot of structural changes in this organization. And many of us that have used Recorded Sound over the years, I have several articles in Recorded Sound that I had quoted and referred to in my PhD dissertation. There's one magnificent article by John Stratton called Crackle, which I think is the landmark description that explained to us in layman's terms what Pickett and Lemko, the Pickett and Lemko study at the Library of Congress did on preservation of recordings, would tell us that our shellac records do deteriorate. We had all thought, well, if you leave a shellac record there, you know, it'll survive forever unless you break it. And it, you know, this was the medium that told us that it was not. And I, you know, congratulated John several years ago on that particular article, which I almost constantly have a Xerox copy of it handy to refer to. The new director of the what is now the British Library National Sound Archive on here, and I hope that name was written correctly, is Christopher Rhodes, who had been the Deputy Director General of the Imperial War Museum from 1964 to 1979, and I must make a point to get there next year, and I didn't get there 2 years ago, and was a UNESCO consultant in 1979. And I read through this, as I haven't seen most of this before, before I look at it here. Design development, instrumental in the design and development of museums and audiovisual archives throughout the world, including the National Audiovisual Archives in both the Philippines and Panama. I guess areas where if you have an HMV record, they will self-destruct. So here now is Christopher Rowan.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I felt the same sense of guilt when I was asked whether I had any audiovisual materials a few moments ago and had to confess that I hadn't got any, as I did when someone asked me why I wasn't using an audio typist and a tape recorder in my office. And I had to admit that I started using it, first of all, I think in 1961, and abolished it in 1964 on the grounds that my secretary was rather prettier to look at than the tape recorder, and much more flexible, too. But I've been invited to talk about the archival policies and strategies of the British Library National Sound Archive. I hesitate over it because it takes a great deal to turn over a lifetime's views about libraries. And I suppose if there's one thing that has come out of my previous career, it's a sense of doubt about the divine mission of librarians to lead us all in all our other fields of media. But nevertheless, I have no option in this. We are the British Library and we're a department of it. It has never failed to amaze me over the past 2 years how often I've encountered evidence of an inability to grasp the full implications of the descriptor National Sound Archive. And it's particularly difficult for those who remember the BIRS, the British Institute of Recorded Sound. After all, today we are still called the Institute for short by just about everyone. For that body, the BIRS, was really a classical musical archive onto which had been grafted three or four additional collections of ethnic music, of wildlife, and spoken literature and drama. The National Sound Archive, which has taken its place, attempts to cover the entire spectrum of sound, from bats to traffic rumble, from jazz to language and dialect, from pop to sound effects. We see ourselves simultaneously, to mention some examples, as the national adjunct to the music library, with its thousands of scores, to the British Museum Natural History, with the animal specimens to which we can attach the sound, to the Victoria and Albert Museum with its historic musical instruments, to the Royal Geographical Society and its anthropological collections, to the Royal College of Music and its numerous students who regard our facilities as part of their working environment. And in this multiplicity of roles, we find ourselves chameleon-like, continually adapting to our surroundings. One moment we consult whether we like it or not with librarians, the next with scientists, the next with explorers, the next with archivists, the next with documentalists, the next with educationalists, the next with historians, the next with actors, the next with musicians, the next with technologists. In fact, the list goes on endlessly. The diversity of those with whom we have to work and whom we seek to serve. And this obviously lays enormous responsibilities on our curators and other staff. And we number to carry out this Herculean task only between 40 and 50 strong. Well, you ask about the strategies of the library. When I was appointed almost exactly two years ago, we had some marvellous discussions on the structuring of the National Sound Archive. We generally concluded that if you were to treat sound records on the same sort of basis as people have chosen over the years to treat books or artifacts, we would need a staff of about 160 people, and that seemed modest enough if you compare it with the 2,600 staff of the British Library. I regret to have to tell you that the 160 will remain a figment of our imagination indefinitely, I suspect, and that we are going to have to get on with our 40 to 50 staff for a very long while. We will have, and I'm making in a sense an advance apology, sections which are desperately below strength, and we shall probably have the most qualified clerical officers in the entire British civil service as they seek to cope simultaneously in one case with all that is required in ethnic music and Western art music. Situated in the heart of museum land, South Kensington, rather than in the exotic, or should I say erotic, heart of Soho, the National Sound Archive is settling into two fine Victorian townhouses astride Exhibition Road. Those you who know us from the past will know that we have a nice red brick house stretching six floors upwards and downwards on the west side of the road. Well, we now are in the process of moving some of our staff and functions into Prince's Gate, which in typical London fashion is the opposite side of the same road, and there we have another six floors which we are trying to gain for ourselves. Since the 1st of April, splendid date to suggest, to choose, 1983, we've been part of the British Library. And we have managed, since that date, to preserve a degree of individualism, even if we haven't technically our independence. And I think it has allowed us to pursue the best interests of the medium of record we deal with, rather than of some others. It's very pleasant to be able to record that being under the aegis of the British Library seems to have worked quite well. The old Board of Governors of the BIRS is being transformed into the Advisory Committee of the National Sound Archive. I say is being because it's taken the lawyers so far 2 years to decide whether or not the governors can be allowed to slide away from their legal responsibilities. I suspect another year will pass before they formally cease to be governors and become advisors. The journal, the Recorded Sound, you had heard mentioned, has been laid to rest, I regret to say, without the emergence of an immediate successor. And this is simply because it was pointed out to me very forcefully that the loss made on the 700 and something subscribers to Recorded Sound was unparalleled in the experience of the British Library, and they weren't proposing to continue to subsidise the world on the basis that they had, that the BIRS had. So in place of a single publication, which I think could genuinely be criticised for trying to be relevant to everyone and failing, We are trying to negotiate setting up of a number of different journals, periodicals, dealing with the different subject areas for which there seems to be a requirement in the United Kingdom. Front runner at the moment is a journal to cover oral history, spoken word. Another strong contender is a journal to cover ethnic music, and a third to cover bioacoustics, wildlife sound. But I think if I continue in this way, there is a danger that I shall be painting a rather fragmented and patchy picture of what the British National Sound Archive is. I thought perhaps I would try and ask a question and then answer it. For what purposes has the NSA been created, apart from the convenience of civil servants rather fed up with dealing with a small unit? The answer is perhaps to provide all, now and in the future, with whatever sound they require in the best possible condition, in an acceptable and appropriate format, accurately authenticated and adequately documented. And that takes some digesting. Now is the first word I'd like to analyse. A truthful archivist will often admit there's no more difficult task than meeting the requirements of the present generation. There never are sufficient resources, so that those that are available, the limited resources available, tend to go towards building up a collection of masters serving future generations. In fact, someone once remarked to me that as far as the National Film Archive was concerned in Britain, the generation they were serving never yet seemed to be born. The problem is most acute when we have only single copies. And as a good archivist, I'm trying to protect the single copy by the imposition of a rigid policy of access copies. At least we have to acknowledge, I think, and I'm very much in favour of serving the present generation, at least we have to acknowledge that we get our resources from the present generation. Unless we please the present generation, there won't be much to develop a structure and infrastructure to serve future generations. So we try and strike a balance there. Second point, I said now and in the future. For the first time, so it seems to me, in any medium of record, archivists have, through digital audio, a means of preserving sound in perfect state indefinitely into the future. That is, I think, quite a remarkable position. That's provided their husbandry is adequate. And that means preserving it for millennia, not just centuries. I think that this fact has barely sunk in to any of us in all its implications. You heard yesterday from Lloyd Stickles that we happen to have chosen Sony's domestic system for various reasons and the Betamax video cassette. You heard of the virtues as he sees it, as we see it, of the equipment, and you heard of some of its limitations. But there is no doubt from a purely archival standpoint that the cassettes are attractive with their limited space requirement, with their protection from dust and so on. In fact, as we look at it, I think the only real drawback that we've seen to the cassettes is that in the use of cassettes for access purposes, if the cassette is indefinitely whisked backwards and forwards, browsing, no doubt the tape will suffer. But we can clearly overcome this, provided we're prepared to put enough money in the right place. This question of permanency is one which particularly interests us. After all, there have been those who've suggested that video discs, laser vision video discs, perhaps represent the most obvious forward storage method. And we've been looking at that. Laser vision discs, you've heard that one might expect a long life from them, but when I tried to pin Philips down to a statement in print on the life of these discs, they have confessed that under tropical and humid conditions, they might not survive as long as they hope. And suggestions have been made that the life could be measured only in decades. So we turn back to the masters. And the alloys used, or lack of alloys, nickel used at the moment, cannot be expected to last indefinitely. The molecular movement of the surface of the metal will limit the life. It's very difficult to say precisely what, but the metallurgists at Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, have looked at this for me to some extent. And even the most attractive alloys that might be used without disadvantage for those masters will probably not have a certain life of more than 600 years. And that assumes that you go to the trouble, perhaps, of using argon to provide an inert environment for the disc, and probably also that you miasma gold plate all your masters to make quite certain that nothing disastrous happens. So when you think of it, this advantage that we have, provided that we can ensure that our successors are good at their husbandry, this advantage of being able to keep some perfectly into the future is an attractive one, and one which we've been using, and I no doubt we shall continue to use. It is not without point that would-be donors to the archive are attracted by the thought that people in thousands of years' time will be able to hear what they sounded like. The arrangements also that one uses with the previous sort of generation storage media, with acetate and so on, also usually require much greater temperature control. And in countries like the Philippines, the bill for the electricity required for air conditioning is itself a great burden. And the fact remains, the fact comes out quite clearly, that any medium of record long-term preservation which requires so much, which costs so much in running expense, clearly is at a disadvantage compared with digital audio tape. So we have been looking very closely in the archive at our preservation arrangements and at other aspects of this. And we're in the process at the moment of appointing a conservation officer whose task will be partially to liaise with the conservation department of the British Library. There's no point being a part of the British Library without taking some advantage from it. But also, that person will have the responsibility of watching all the masters, as it were, and making sure they know what's happening to them throughout the archive, and can wrap over the knuckles any member of staff who deviates from the appropriate codes of practice. We also, at the same time, are looking at other aspects of conservation and storage. And I won't weary you on that side, but I would simply say that one of the greatest advantages being in a library or being part of the library is that if you have to accommodate the miles of books that they have to every year, even the wildest extravagances in our collecting policy won't result in accretions which can't be sort of slipped in through the back door. I doubt whether we shall have a real problem on that front while they have the problems they face with books. So serving the distant future becomes a reality, and with it the question of selection assumes yet greater significance. We recognise that we are unlikely to have the resources to switch over entirely to digital audio, nor is it desirable that we do so. The question is rather to what extent and where we do so. There are now two questions to be answered. First, do we retain any given item in its received analogue format? And secondly, should its source content be transferred to digital audio tape? The archive has its selection procedures, especially developed to cope with broadcasts. But it's clear that we still have a long way to go to sort out our priorities in our programme of transferring to digital audio. And there are also the complementary priorities to be resolved. As to whether we record in the field directly with digital equipment or whether we stay with analog. We have had very little experience so far with Sony equipment recording in the field, except that Lloyd will tell you of some of the disadvantages of hunting it £40 plus across the Indian subcontinent. And there is no doubt that this attractive new glossy equipment attracts customs officers and other officials. As you begin to work out, efficiency, it's not spent arguing with customs officers that this is really worth only about £400 and is second hand. They won't believe you, and all they want is their, well, the bureaucracy, of course, of India is legendary, all due to the British. Also, our people who go out and record plays, those concerned with drama, are not pleased to have to hump the digital equipment up ladders and into various places in their efforts to record, and they will obviously stick with the Nagra or something similar as long as we allow them to do so. Nevertheless, and assuming it doesn't rain hard, another obvious disadvantage, the equipment clearly is going to come in for studio purposes and for many others, and only more difficult assignments in the field probably will stay, as far as we're concerned, with analogue recording equipment. The selection process that I mentioned is another headache. And I will only say that from Patrick Saul, I've inherited the most marvellous rules for selection. The sad fact is that we never seem to have time to apply them. The best form of selection, of course, is accidental destruction. And I mean that. And I mean that quite seriously. As a historian of the mid-19th century, I heaved a great sigh of relief when, after 1857, most of the military records vanished, because in 1908, when they moved from one war office to the other, they decided that these were not really worth keeping, and they junked them. And had the records continued at the pre-1857 rate, I don't think we should have had anyone dare to attempt to deal with that period of our military history. So. I know only too well, by example, in the Imperial War Museum, when, for example, the Navy's carried out a systematic policy of selection, it has been absolutely certain that anything we want today has been destroyed. So I think selection is best avoided if you possibly can, and leave it to your successors. Don't waste your own time. The next point I have is with whatever sound they require. Well, that is an impossible phrase. I mean, how can we supply them with what they require if we have only about 10% of our collection catalogue? It is very difficult when, for so much of our collection, the accession registers are the only guide. And we do recognise, and we have been recognising for a long while, that the shortfall in cataloguing in the archive is perhaps our biggest headache of all. Well, it is after having enough staff, having enough money, having enough space and buildings. Not surprisingly, the question of cataloguing the collection has loomed large in the recent history of the archive. It has long been recognised that this is synonymous with computerisation, but none of the very serious attempts of the past 4 or 5 years to identify the mode and nature of computerising the catalogue, which is likely to be most successful, have themselves been successful. And yet another way is underway, another attempt is underway at the present. Fortunately, I came from the museum world and was thoroughly indoctrinated through ICOM, the International Council of Museums, with the view that the Museum Documentation Association of Great Britain led the world in museum cataloguing by computer. So cutting across my colleagues' preferences to go to librarians and others, I've gone straight to the Museum's Documentation Association and said to them, we like your GOS package, as it's so called. Investigation now has shown that it doesn't work in the form in which it existed, so we've modified it. And to get my way, or our way in this, I've had to promise the British Library that we'll spin off in MARC, according to AACR2, the appropriate entries for their great database. But nevertheless, we go into computerisation through the modified GOS package of the Museums Documentation Association, which is splendid because there are a lot of people there who know already the problems of applying it, who applied it to photographs, to films, to all sorts of. In fact, there is barely, I can't think of anything they haven't tried applying their system to. And it's very useful to have the MDA behind us. So we have made a start there, and one I think, I hope, it won't be possible to reverse, and nor one where procrastination will be readily condoned. Recognizing that we could not ourselves hope to input the entries relating to hundreds of thousands of units which we hold, we've successfully hived off all present and future UK discs and cassette production, as well as anything imported in commercial quantity. The project embracing this is a joint one with the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society, and is expressly to establish a national discography as a database, and of course, derivative publications from it. Well, I discovered quite quickly that it was a dangerous thing to start discussing the forms of publication that we would have after year two or three or four or five in establishing the database, because we would have to fight the British Library for money for publications against all comers. But we have managed to get agreement that we are aiming at a monthly microfiche publication. And that is our present and immediate goal, but I hope only the first. Now, the effect of establishing what I think will probably be called National Discography Limited in the private sector, which of course is the kind of policies that Mrs. Thatcher now just doesn't condone. She pushes us very vigorously into commercial activity. It's the only way we can survive. The British Library is getting less than half the rate of inflation in increment, in financial increment each year, so we really do have to earn the balance. At any rate, the setting up of the National Discography will leave our catalogues free to concentrate on our earlier holdings, including obsolescent or obsolete, depends the way you look at it, after listening to your meeting, 78's, our 78 collection, and the whole of the rest of the field, including, very significantly, our own recordings, field recordings, studio recordings. So what we are trying to do is, through this microfiche publication, to position, if you like, across the country, where retailers buy it and university libraries and others, a means of getting at our holding and to mark up subsequent editions, obviously not the first, because the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society has privileged access to information of intending pressing and so on. We hope to sort of get the information out almost before the appearance of the discs, and therefore, but subsequently we will hope to annotate the it to indicate where we hold the material. Our present rate of acquisitions is fluctuating wildly from month to month. But in good months, we go above 90% of present issues. And this is on voluntary donation. There's a great deal of talk in the country about statutory deposit, and I think it will eventually come in. But at the moment, we depend upon goodwill and arm twisting. It would be very pleasant to report that and thinking about access to our collections through catalogue, that the World Encyclopedia of Recorded Music, which is, of course, as most of you know, the life work of Eric Hughes, at least it has been for the last 2.5 decades or more, that we had solved the problem of its publication, particularly as Eric is not very far from retirement. But we haven't. We dragged the minister around and got him to make all the right remarks. This is the Minister for the Arts. About it being perhaps the most important project that we had on hand. But I'm afraid we have not succeeded yet in finding the £250,000 that we would require to make Eric's entries intelligible and to go actually as far as publication. But clearly, if he retires, we can perhaps retain him as a consultant, but there is no doubt that he inputs a vast amount in his own time, and it will be very difficult to keep it going as well as it has been kept going for a very long while. So I think this is quite a high priority. The next point I made in my answering that question was in the best possible condition. We are most anxious, that we handle things once and once only and not keep pulling them and sort of doing this and then putting them back and pulling the same things again. We've far too large a stock of materials to permit double or triple handling or multiple handling. That means that at the same time that we transfer the sonic content from its original carrier to its permanent digital audio format, We want to process it where it seems desirable to remove unwanted sound. Well, you heard yesterday from Lloyd, so I won't waste time in adding to what he said, except that we've got another 2 years certainly out of our research student, who seems to have his head screwed on reasonably, in Cambridge University's Department of Engineering, and I hope that we will be able to keep him indefinitely improving the software that goes with the, well, nearly £70,000 worth of equipment we bought from Neve, and which you saw photographs of yesterday. We do certainly feel that that it's part and parcel of our business to ensure that on that transition from the historic carrier to the permanent carrier, if I can put it that way, we get rid of the sound derived from deterioration in the one case, and also in the other, when we're field recording and something goes wrong. In India, not so long ago, as Lloyd will remember, just in the middle of quite a significant interview, the waiter tripped up and everything went flying in every direction, but the interviewee continued through it. I hope that we can remove the sound of smashing porcelain. Tone it down. And that will be quite a test. Just in the middle of quite a significant interview, the waiter tripped up and everything went flying in every direction, but the interviewee continued through it. I hope that we can remove the sound of smashing porcelain. Please tone it down. And that will be quite a test, I should say. We also, anyone who's tried making films, as we have, even in Britain, we'll recognise that almost never is the sky free from the drone of aircraft, at least not in our area. And there are times when the drone of aircraft is as irritating as that of air conditioning units in India, or overhead fans that no one's bothered to lubricate. We obviously hope, in other words, to improve things, if that's the right word. I'm sure a lot of you would disagree. And as we're in the process of setting up a department of ambient, or a section of ambient sound, I know that will be contended shortly. But still, we're trying to do our best to provide future historians, research students, with what they think they're going to listen to, rather than with what happens to be there, necessarily. And just to underline the emphasis that we're placing upon the continued preservation of the original carrier, well, we will, and the sound reproducing equipment we've got, Lloyd is in fact now dignified with a double appointment. He's also curator of artifacts. And in that sense, we are trying to lean, or at least merge, towards the museum's world. Our new listening area will actually have also some showcases for equipment, and we hope to build up our collection of sound reproducing equipment to a pretty complete level. In an acceptable and appropriate format is the next point. When we are asked for copies and are permitted under copyright to respond, we certainly hope to be able to do so. Unfortunately, because of the restructuring in the archive, our transcription service is more conspicuous by its absence than its presence. There was no way we could avoid this, because the condition of merger into the public service was that the whole thing, the whole of our organisation, was looked at, staff inspected and restructured. And anyone who knows the public mind, I mean the official mind, will know that that's a splendid opportunity to mark time and save money and make no appointments and fill no vacancies. And that's exactly what has happened. For 2 years we've virtually been running down, and only now, with the staffing section behind us, with a new complement established, with the new designations agreed, and only the amount of money that they get still being discussed, we are free to try and fill these places. So, coming back to the transcription service, we are now trying to restart the transcription service on the 1st of September, and unfortunately for some, but it's a sign of the times, as a commercial service, I'm even going to have to feed into the computer the cost of the space that we occupy, as well as the services that we draw on, and run it as a genuinely commercial service. That is the only way we can have a transcription service. So the question of listening to our materials, there is no way that today people can be required to come into London to listen to what they wish to listen to. I was forcibly reminded of this when I was responsible for the Museums and Galleries Commission investigation of local museums and so on, and was trying to arrange for a visit to the Orkneys. And for those who think the United Kingdom is a small place, Shetland and Orkneys are closer to Oslo and Norway considerably. It costs only £80 to go to Oslo return, but it costs £246 return to come to London. And that £246 charge is an index of the reluctance, obviously, the impossibility of using our services. So we are now embarking upon a regional service. We have opened the first one in Yorkshire. The next one, I hope, will be in Devon in the southwest. And bit by bit, we will open regional centres to provide a facility for listening, so that we are not treating those who live in London as privileged individuals. Within the archive itself, the disgraceful accommodation that we previously had, most attractive in decor, I agree, but five places is ludicrous for a national listening service, will be expanded to around 25 or 30. And we will actually have a group listening facility as well. This is not pie in the sky, they're actually doing it at the moment, and it's due for completion next year. So things are, in that sense, becoming more accessible. We are certainly not going to dictate to anyone the format that they will get things on. If they want it on cassettes, they'll get it. I enjoy talking to Dietrich Schuller and the Austrians about the unacceptability of cassettes, but we are not, I'm afraid, going to subscribe that. We certainly feel that there are so many instances in sound archiving when the best is the enemy of the acceptable or the good, that one has to watch out for it. And certainly we will be doing our best to respond in kind, whatever is requested, provided. I don't say if you want a wire recording that we will furnish it on wire. But my next point is accurately authenticated and adequately documented. Well, we are trying to reform our house, certainly in this area, and to ensure that when, as I've just done, I send someone to Costa Rica to record bats, he does in fact remember to put down all the parameters that we use. Rigidly, we use the appropriate pro forma guides to ensure that all the parameters are put in. And the parameters, obviously, are rather wide-ranging. I myself was recording fish on coral reefs in the Maldives quite recently as a means of keeping in touch with what it's like to record in the field, and recording the temperature of the current direction and all the other things, as well as on my Formica board, noting all the species of fish, is quite demanding, and one unquestionably needs rigidly to follow this, because I've had experience in the Imperial War Museum of the dangers, unless you hammer these factors in, of relying upon the good sense and industry of the person recording or the person photographing to put the data in. We used to think, for example, in the Imperial War Museum, that the collection of First World War photographs that you could accept as gospel the caption. Until we did our anniversary of the First World War and we went out to France and so on, Gallipoli and all the other places, with all these photographs, and we realized that the error rate was in excess of 30%. One third of the photographs in the First War collection, the chap had clearly got very tired, and at the end of two or three days had annotated his negs and got it wrong, crossed them over, and everything else under the sun. So we do not want to get an error rate of 3%, much less 30%, in the data that we record about recording. So, well, it's not so difficult, obviously, when you're doing it yourself. When we are taking donations, then it becomes very difficult to to sort that out, but obviously we must try. And I'm certainly giving every encouragement to those in the library and the sort of documentary side of our archive to gather in wherever they can every conceivable background document which relates to the material that we are collecting, the audio material. I mean, we're not purists. We see our role to serve the historian of music, of social conduct, or whatever it may be, with the best possible historical evidence. And that means that we are not going to disregard, for example, the possibilities of video coverage. And just as we now take the television video coverage, a piece which goes with pop as it comes out, and which is obviously an inseparable element of pop, we are committed to a policy of videoing wherever it amplifies the record, and where we can't video, well, a photographic picture. We're just at the moment purchasing a few cameras, 35mm cameras, to make sure that photographs are taken wherever they can be taken, so that the record is as complete as possible. David Attenborough made it quite clear, he's an advisor on the wildlife side, that he would not endorse a policy of video with audio on animals, pointing out to me very forcefully indeed that where you could get the microphone was much more ambitious, you could be much more ambitious about it than where you could get the camera in the field. So wildlife area, we obviously won't try and emulate Attenborough's own example. So we have that gives you some idea of the sort of scene. And very briefly, in minus 1 minute plus, I will try to give you one or two other main facts which describe our activity. We are very fortunate, or unfortunate, depends how you look at it, as a part of the British Library, therefore being, as the British Library is hived off the British Museum, and as the British Museum considered itself the museum of the world, we therefore are not prevented from being, but actually encouraged to regard the world as our parish. Well then, you, having said that, we obviously recognise the de facto circumstance that the Library of Congress believes that the Americas are its parish, and we are hopefully going to try and work out from all this a logical interlocking policy. But within our worldview, practically of course, we have the remaining colonies high after the United Kingdom, the Commonwealth, the ex-Commonwealth, and the English-speaking countries. So we relate to those. The only area we specifically exclude is the sort of developed countries which we believe ought to have, even if they haven't, the archival facilities to preserve their own present musical heritage as it comes out. And in those instances, we seek only to have a sample. I'm talking in theoretical terms now, I would hasten to add, because what we can do is very limited. But I mean, very recently, within this month, past month, I have agreed with UNESCO that we will take, for example, all the non-English recordings of a project in Ceylon in Sri Lanka, a folklife recording project, which has yielded many, many thousands, I think about 3,000 hours of tape, of interviewing locals on what they remember of custom, and that is something where we hope to hold the master. So we've got a very wide view of things in that direction. We are particularly interested in English language, and I'm pleased to say that in the restructuring, I've been able to persuade the powers that be that we should have a keeper of language and dialect, as well as one ambient sound, industrial mechanical noise, and so on. So slowly, we intend to try to become a genuinely national sound archive rather than, as I say, a rather unbalanced one. I won't... I'll cut out some of the points that I've got here. In terms of strategy, where we happen to lie at the moment as a part of the British Library is probably as good as any place. We might have been a part of the British Film Institute. Well, My feeling is that had we been that, we would have been worse off. My experience of working closely with film archivists for 20 years or so is that so many of them receive film as an art form, and only as an art form, although they do lip service to film as a means of communication, that we would have had severe problems in that particular area. So we are anxious to develop the obvious links that we can from the British Library's existing world network, from the India Office Library and places like that, which are part of the British Library, and to utilise their chain of contacts around the world to assist us in the pursuance of our own policies of collection. We are also extremely irritated by the political bias that has crept into parts of oral history activity in the United Kingdom, and we intend not to subscribe in any measure to that political bias. We certainly have no time for suggestions that oral history is, shall we say, I've heard it said, applicable to the working classes, but doesn't really relate to any level, social level, that anyone would really want to study. That kind of thing, which still exists in the United Kingdom, is something which we are doing our best to correct. Therefore, we do see a particularly important part of our mission as the mission as our mission in the area of oral history and the correction of some of these biases. We are, for example, aware that there are universities in the United Kingdom which will not accept sound recordings as a part of the evidence that one can use with one's thesis or dissertation. This is a monstrous situation, obviously, and we are doing our best to point out to people like that that if they are historians, they will be critical of all their sources, and they will apply the same tests to material of every kind to ensure that what they are collecting is and what they're doing and what they're admitting is admitted on a rational and intelligent basis, and not one which is biased. We have had problems, now surmounted, I'm happy to say, in getting the establishment to agree that all forms of music should be treated on an equal footing. We have at last got an acceptance of the fact that jazz and popular music are not some kind of low activity, and that they are to be treated as areas for scholarship, they are a part of our culture, and that no one is entitled necessarily to extrapolate 19th century fine art standards in some peculiar fashion to the present activities of the century. So we are doing our best, and it's reflected in our structure, in the grading and ranking, to be impartial in the treatment of the different areas. Obviously, when you come to things like language and dialect, and we haven't a tradition in this area, we have a certain limited collection, it is difficult to argue from scratch that it should be treated in the same way and on the same ranking, but it is. We equally recognise that in oral history we are going to have to cover a very wide range. We cover drama, literature, reminiscence, actuality, and so on. I've been negotiating for the right to the gallery. We accept that there is a valid activity in collecting simply the sound of the voices of historic figures and of ordinary people in the street, and we're trying to do that. I think it may sound that we're overstretching ourselves, we probably are, but the gate is open at the time of a merger to change everything, and if you miss that opening, that window, you've missed it for good. Because the gate is still open, we're still rushing to complete our metamorphosis into a national sound archive, and I think, at least I hope, that we are reasonably on the way there. Thank you very much.